Hey, this is Brian Crescenti.
And I'm Tony Bernhardt Jr.
And we're back for another episode of This is Level Infinite.
What do you have planned for us today, Brian?
Oh man, I am so excited about this one. But, you know, before we get started, I'm curious, Tony, are you into horror movies at all?
Absolutely. But I've watched so many, they really have to be unique. I'm talking pacing, the visuals, the suspense. It's all got to be there.
Yeah, you know, I actually have a spreadsheet.
What?
Yeah, more than 1,200 movies listed on it.
Wow.
I won't tell you how many of those I've watched, but it's a lot. And because of that, I like to look for, you know, different aspects of horror, different sort of themes. And it's not just horror movies I'm into. I love reading horror books. And of course, I love horror video games. There's tons of amazing horror games out there to play, from Resident Evil and Silent Hill and Dead Space to games like Dead by Daylight and Evil Within.
All right, I suspect this is heading somewhere.
How right you are, Tony. Today, we're talking about the absolutely amazing Level Infinite game, GTFO.
They wake us from our nightmares. A descent into a vast underground complex. There's only one rule.
Let us just get in and get out.
Bring it what it wants. All we know is we'll have to work together. Or we'll die together.
Oh yeah, man, I actually played this and it's absolutely nerve-wracking. I was so into it, I was late for a dentist appointment.
Well, that's like going from one horror to another. Yeah, it's so great. And it's impossible to talk about what makes GTFO so special without a short history lesson on the developers at 10 Chambers. The studio was founded in Sweden back in 2015 by Ulf Andersson, the game designer behind the cooperative shooter franchise Payday. The guiding principle of the new studio is to try and push the envelope on cooperative gaming. So these developers have spent years working on some of the biggest co-op games out there, and they felt they basically weren't cooperative enough. We chatted with Simon Wiklund, the narrative director at the studio, about those early days.
We discussed this, Ulf and I and other team members, and we agreed that a lot of games claim to be cooperative shooters. You know, yeah, you can cooperate if you want to, but for the most part, you're just playing like alongside one another and you're on the same team, but you can sort of run off on your own and there's no real danger. Whereas we wanted to create an experience where it would be fatal for the survival of the team if one person ran off on their own and tried to do their own thing. We wanted to make a game that's so hard and punished sort of failure to cooperate. So that, you know, you would die basically if the entire team would wipe if you didn't coordinate and communicate and counter bullets and so on.
GTFO is sort of meant to be their love letter to co-op games. Or maybe a better way of saying it, it's meant to be the true co-op game.
Yeah, you know, that's right. One of the main reasons they decided to make the game a horror survival game was because they knew the genre would sort of force people to be more cooperative. It also was a great way to make the game hard as nails. Simon said that difficulty forces people to talk a lot to each other.
You know, where can we find ammunition and who has ammo and can you share it and all of that? It's a good idea to just create a lack of resources for the players. The game gets harder because you don't run around with a lot of confidence. You can take on whatever is around the next corner. You're always like sort of scavenging, looking around, trying to find a few more bullets so that hopefully you can survive the next onslaught of monsters. It all sort of felt natural to go with horror because the horror theme inspires players to keep together. The atmosphere in itself sort of tells the players silently that you're not supposed to run off on your own in this environment, because when the teens do in slasher films, you know, they die one by one. So the concept of it being difficult came first, and then it was a natural sort of decision to make it a horror game and survival horror specifically after that.
Okay, before we get ahead of ourselves into how this game came to be, there are probably people listening to this right now who have no idea what we're talking about. So let's first explain how you play the game and what it's like once you're dropped right into the melee.
Yeah, it's such a strange game from the moment you start it. The first thing you actually see when you run the game is your screen goes black and text starts to sort of type across the screen. It sort of looks like your computer is rebooting. And if you read some of that text, among some of this sort of random numbers and letters, you'll find things like a prisoner ID number, an alias, which happens to be your name in the game, and things like your mental evaluation listed as unstable, and a suggested action listed as retire. It also says override in red. So once all this happens, you're left with the option to press and hold a button with your mouse that says inject. And that starts the game. Once in, you equip, matchmake, and then literally drop into the game.
Yeah, literally. I like how the game shows a first-person perspective of you being maneuvered over a massive pit while you're strapped inside some type of cage. Then, it basically drops you straight down. I mean, you can see the walls flying by as your character hyperventilates. It's really, really tense.
Yeah, and then once you land, it essentially becomes this first-person shooter where you have to explore this massive cave system, searching for items and trying not to be killed by monsters before you're able to return.
I know we're going to talk a bit more about the story in a few, so I'll stop you there. Let's get back to how they developed this game.
Sure. Yeah, so Simon said in designing the game, the developers were inspired by a lot of different fictional works, not least of which were several of the Alien movies.
Well, there's a lot of Alien in there. There's this threat of some almost animal-like, ferocious monster, you know, breed of monsters out there in the dark that you have to sort of try to survive, and you don't have enough bullets and you don't have enough firepower. There's so many of them. You're outnumbered. You know, you might have weapons, but they will outnumber you and sort of take the bullets. A few of them will die, but then there will be a second wave that will come and just overpower you. There's a lot of aliens in that, the second Alien movie, I guess. And then the third Alien movie might not be that good of a movie compared to the first two ones. But what we liked about that one was the fact that it takes place on this prison sort of planet, in this prison facility. And we liked that they all felt like damaged and sort of scum, that you would question whether maybe they deserve this, you know, maybe this is part of the punishment that they're stuck inside this facility with this monster. It's sort of a story-wise a mashup between Aliens, where there are a lot of monsters that can kill you, and this third movie where there are prisoners who try to survive stuck inside with the monsters, sort of. So Alien 3 is a huge inspiration for the story. But then we looked at other things that we just wanted to avoid. That also inspired us. Ulf and I played a lot of the first Destiny game. We played some of the sequel as well and actually just jumped back into it throughout the holidays. But what bugged us about that game and The Division as well is that they paint this picture of you being the only one who can save the universe, or you're the only one who can save Manhattan. You want to buy this weapon, by the way? Like, why would you not give it to me if I'm the only one, if I'm like the savior, sort of? And it just felt that there's this mismatch between who they paint you out to be in the story and then how they treat you in terms of the economy within that universe. Like, you need to fight so much in order to get the better weapons. Like, just give me the best weapon so that I can make sure that your shop can continue existing, because this threat is about to destroy this entire planet that this shop is sitting on, and I'm the only one who can stop that threat, you know. So it just felt like a little bit weird, that mismatch or that disconnect between who you're supposed to be and how people treat you. That's part of the reason why we chose to go with these prisoners, because someone's keeping you captive and you're a disposable asset of sorts in their scheme. And then you have to prove yourself to be one of the prisoners that can actually carry out the missions. And they trust you to carry these valuable weapons, which are lost forever. If you would die down there in the complex, these weapons would be lost. So they don't want to give that to the prisoners who can't be trusted to actually carry out the mission and come back up, sort of. So you have to prove yourself. And that felt like it matches the concept of leveling up or getting the better stuff if you prove yourself to be good enough. You know, you complete enough maps or levels or whatever.
The team also spent a lot of time trying to find the right balance, both for difficulty, but also in terms of the learning curve.
And here's the thing, a game like this can be really, really tricky because the developers want to make it hard and they want people to rely on one another, but that could also lead to a lot of anger and annoyance if someone messes up.
Yeah, you know, I actually experienced some of that anger firsthand from both sides, funny enough. First, as a newbie, and then later as someone getting frustrated with a newbie.
Oh man, you definitely would have been frustrated with me. I think I died 3 times within the first 10 minutes.
Yeah, well, and you know, while people did get annoyed with me, none of that annoyance ever really rose to what I would describe as toxic, which is obviously key. At least not in my sessions. I know probably it happens sometimes, but I don't think it's as bad as in other games. I asked Simon how they worked to strike that balance.
Well, we winged it, really, and just hoped that the community would be, like, not toxic, I guess. We hoped that, you know, people who play cooperative games is a small enough community and sort of understand the concept and understand how hard the game is, you know, and are clever enough to not, like, go into bullying of any new people that comes in. I'm sure that exists, but it hasn't been reported to us as a huge problem with the matchmaking and the community as a whole, sort of. People seem to really think that the GTFO community is healthy, you know, and that people are, even though people can get frustrated and yelling a little bit at the new players, because if you do the wrong thing, I mean, there's friendly fire, you can just kill your teammates. It's so easy to grief, you know, to grief play and just mess up someone else's game. And we started thinking about ways to maybe counter that in some way, but it's there's no point really in, there's always going to be a way, you know, to sort of, even if you get some sort of a rating from your teammates, and if you start killing them, you will get poor rating. And then after a while, if your rating is poor enough, you can't be match made, you know, you can't join other people's matches and stuff like that. It's really hard to make some sort of a system where you can circumvent those sort of system, you know. So we just trusted sort of the community to be mature enough to not, you know, be short-sighted and just jumping around games and ruining it for other players.
Simon said the studio designed GTFO to be a mashup of stealth and action play, and talked about how much of their design decisions fed back into the strong need for stealth.
Yeah, Brian, when you were talking about the game earlier, you mentioned this thing you did where you and two other players had to basically silently kill these three sleepers. I did the same thing, and it's freaking nerve-wracking, but at the same time, it feels really cinematic.
Yeah, you know, GTFO has some really neat organic moments in it. And in that particular case, we came upon a group of these sleeping monsters. So in GTFO, most of the creatures you come across are initially asleep. If you're careful not to be too noisy or shine your light directly on them, you can actually walk right up to them, sort of tiptoe, I guess, and then dispatch them with a knife or a spear or another melee weapon. So my team and I walked into a cave filled with these things and positioned ourselves around these different sleepers. But to take them all out without them attacking us first, we had to do this kill move all at the exact same time. And this is where the group chat really comes in. The game also has a button you can press to start a quiet countdown, just in case you don't have a microphone or maybe you can't talk for some reason while you're playing. So we initiated that, and when that countdown got to zero, we all struck and took out our four enemies all at the same time. It felt so cool.
Yeah, my team tried to do the exact same thing as far as the sleepers. I mean, we got right up close. The other two members had played before. They had their knives out. And I launched a rocket to wake everyone up.
They're like, one. And then everybody does their stealth move and you're like, yeah. Rocket launch! Well, so, you know, I don't think Simon really was thinking about that when they were designing the game.
Stealthily killing the monsters while they were sleeping felt like a good, like, it's a meticulous sort of process, because if you see three monsters, or if you're three players and you see five monsters, you decide, okay, these three are close enough together, so we go for these three, because if they wake up, we have this little pocket of monsters and we can kill them all pretty quickly, because we can have one monster each. So then if, by any chance, any other monster wakes up, we can sort of bum rush those monsters and just kill them quickly. That inspires communication, because you need to start talking within the team. Like, okay, I position myself here, you position yourself there, and then we need to do a countdown so we hit them at the same time. Because if I hit mine first, yours might wake up and start attacking you or some other player. Or they all wake up, you know, there's a chain reaction throughout the room and all the monsters wake up, you know. And there might be monsters further in the darkness that you haven't even seen that are coming out of the darkness as soon as you accidentally sort of alert one of the monsters that is close to you. So there's all this tension, you know. And that seemed to match the sort of atmosphere that we wanted in the game, that you're always close to dying, you're always close to one wrong step and everything goes to hell, basically.
So they're definitely not going to spoon-feed you, like a lot of other games do. You've got to flex those brain muscles and put your noggin to work.
Of course, because some of the team worked on the Payday titles, they also brought, a lot of lessons with them from that cooperative game and applied those lessons to this new take on the genre. And Simon said that, in fact, back when they were working on Payday, they were actually inspired by zombie-killing cooperative shooter Left 4 Dead.
The first Payday game was basically, let's do Left 4 Dead, but replace the zombies with cops. And then that was it. There's some more complexity to it where you have to carry out objectives, you know, and drill through. There's a story being told, you know, of a heist, basically. And it's closer between the places where you have to actually carry out actions. If you compare the game to Left 4 Dead, where you're moving greater distances and then you come to like this drawbridge and you have to wait until the bridge is lowered or whatever. There's some of those scripted events or places where you have to sort of make a stand. Payday was more, you know, that was closer together. Like it was all the time, like the drill is malfunctioning and you need to fix it and stuff like that. We did a lot right, you know, with that game. It became one of those, not early, but, you know, at least prevailing franchises in that genre of games, you know, the Left 4 Dead being the grandfather of that genre. And then you have, I guess, Killing Floor, which is more like, you know, just wave after survival and not a lot of scenario, really. We were often compared to Left 4 Dead and Killing Floor, you know, when we did Payday. And what we realized is there's a lot of potential in the genre and a lot of, not a lot, but necessarily, but you know, there's a hole in the market for something that it has that is within the genre, but has a different flavor. And that was something that was really hard and more tactical and slow paced.
Simon said that they want players to prepare, to explore the caves meticulously and stealthily, you know, without rocket launchers, and then prepare for the coming onslaught of monsters by figuring out how best to set up turrets, mines, and even direct the flow of the enemy to killing floors.
It's more strategic or slow-paced, almost like a Rainbow Six sort of game, you know? Much more tactical and it requires more patience, you know, from the players. It's not a quick fix. You're not jumping into a match in order to just to pop some, you know, headshots and then you're done. You have to really like invest. It's like 45 minutes to 1 hour and 15 minutes or something to complete a map. And the tension rises all the time. Now in the 1.0 release, we have actually have checkpoints where if you die, you can choose to start from the checkpoint instead of starting from the beginning of the map, which is one of those measures we took to make the game a little bit more accessible because there's a quit window, as we call it. Level designers, where it's like, this is a place in the game loop where if you die, you would like, oh, let's quit because I'm done. Like, I'm tired of this. But if you're presented with the option to start from not all the way from the beginning, you might stay and play a little bit more, you know? So it's one of those things where we did try to make the game a little bit more accessible.
So GTFO went into early access back in December 2019. But it didn't get its official release until 2 years later, right?
Yeah, exactly. So version 1.0 hit on December 10th, 2021, actually during the Game Awards 2021.
Get it! Over here! I found it! Grab the item! Close the door! Close the door!
Why are we here? Terrible things that we do to deserve such hell.
Okay, so let's talk about the story and what sets GTFOs apart from other games.
What's interesting here is that GTFO doesn't have a very strong, overt story. There aren't really many cutscenes, and there's no setup beyond what I described earlier. All you really know is that you're one in a team of four prisoners who are forced to go down into this underground cave complex built on the site of an asteroid crater and asked to retrieve things by someone known as the Warden. To find the story, you have to actually dig around. This form of narrative device in a game isn't completely new, but Simon said this approach of almost hiding the story from the players seems to be working really well.
The community is, and we know this, like the community is very starved for story, you know. So they take everything they get, you know. It feels like other games can give you cake. Every day you get cake. You get, in GTFO, you get toenail clippings, you know. It's like scraps. it's so little. And the people who are into the story sort of have to settle for that. Like, they have to be fine with, like, this is what we get. And then they're super happy with what little they get. You know, GTF is never going to be a game where you get like, oh, we cross this barrier or we come into this room and then there's a cutscene or some cinematic sequence. You know, we don't have that sort of a production pipeline. We don't want to make a game where we're taking away the control from the players.
Yeah, I couldn't help but notice that too. If you're just there to play the game, there's not a whole lot of backstory thrown at you. It can come across as just a multiplayer game without a story.
You know, and that's the thing that's so fascinating. It actually does have a pretty deep story, but much like the game itself, you have to work really hard to find it. I chased down the game's writer to talk about his approach to the narrative a bit. Adam Gascoigne has quite a bit of experience as a game writer and designer. He wrote the Doom reboot and Doom Eternal, as well as games like Call of Duty 3. He said he was brought in to work on GTFO's story as a contractor after the folks at 10 Chambers watched a documentary about the making of the Doom reboot, and his name was dropped by Hugo Martin, the game's director.
Well, they had kind of a loose idea of the story, but they weren't really focused on it. Ulf, the game director, knew roughly what they wanted, and so did Simon. The two of them together had come up with some ideas, but they basically needed it organized. Right? And they needed someone to caretake it, someone who would actually curate all of these ideas and then expand it to new areas. So they pitched to me the ideas, but they've been very loose with it. They kind of let you play. They let me play as much as I want to. And then Simon will just, as the narrative director, he'll just reel it back in. He'll, in areas where he thinks, like, we can't go there yet. Let's not do that, you know. So, yeah, they had a rough outline of stuff. It's kind of like that Pixar story where they had, I believe they had 7 movies when they first got together, 7 movie ideas, and then they said they were going to make them one at a time. Ulf and Simon are kind of like that with the story. They have all of these ideas that we're slowly working through, so there's still a lot left to reveal, but they brought me on to help kind of guide that process.
Adam said that one of the things that drew him to the game was the approach the developers were taking to the narrative. Rather than writing the story ahead of the game's design or alongside it, he was basically asked to build the story around a relatively finished game. He also likes creating a story that needs to be discovered rather than just handed over to players. Something he calls a story based on Easter eggs. It's an approach he first played around with while working on the zombie mode in Call of Duty World at War.
We had a designer stroke sound designer there called Brian Toohey. He was actually the head of the sound department at that time. And he had an idea for story, which was, let's basically make a story based on Easter eggs, right? So finding all of these things like hidden in the world. And I ran with it and we enjoyed it. And we thought, wow, the community is really responding well to this. Like every time we went onto the forums, people were talking about suggestions about what does element 451 do? What is the background of Dr. Richtofen? And I can't remember the other characters' names, but that's actually what influenced me to continue it, right? I realized that from working with Brian that his idea was like, oh yeah, that's the thing I want to do. I want to keep writing stories that are just like that, where the audience is speculating and they have to go off the beaten path to find stuff. And yeah, I tried doing more traditional stuff. That's why I went to Naughty Dog. And much as I enjoyed it, it just didn't excite me as much.
I love that. It sounds like a lot. I mean, Adam and 10 Chambers are relying pretty heavily on the community to uncover the story.
Yeah, you know, it's absolutely right. If the game's players aren't passionate enough, aren't smart enough, then the story remains buried. Fortunately, Adam said that hasn't been a problem.
It's been really stunning seeing the way how smart the community are. it's exciting to me, you know, like you can't dumb down your audience or think that they're not going to get it because they're usually 2 steps ahead of us. All of the ideas that we have on paper, they end up getting there on their own with the minimal amount of information. Like we just give them just suggestions and they will start having conversations about where it could go, what that could mean, how that person is connected to that, how they ended up where they're at. And that to me is probably the most exciting thing, is seeing thousands of people engaged with the story that you're so passionate about at the same level. And, you know, I don't know if they know this, but how much a part of the creative process they are is also really interesting to me. Like having silent writers, we're not literally taking their ideas, but their exuberance and their suggestions, they're all part of the matrix that ends up with the final story, you know, that we come up with. That's very exciting. There's a foundation, I keep using that word, but there is an idea, right? So we know if no one said anything else, if no one read anything and no one made any theories, there were no fan theories, we have a complete story, start to end. But what we have is branches off of that main tree trunk of possible areas that we can lead it, that we may not have the full story. Like, you know, when they wrote the first episode of Lost, they didn't know where the 20th episode was going. And actually, if you look at Breaking Bad, I don't know if you've heard any of the podcasts about Breaking Bad, but I read somewhere that the very first shot of the season, like that cold open that they would do, they often didn't know what that meant. They just knew that it looked cool and they're like, we'll get there, we'll get there, we'll plant the seeds. That's kind of how I feel what we're doing here. We have a rough idea, but some of the suggestions that come out of the community are better than what we have on paper. And, you know, I have big spreadsheets and I have walls filled with notes. And if that idea connects in the overall matrix, then that might be something we can run with. So nothing's set in stone, but it's molded out of clay.
Yeah, it's one thing for players to be individually invested in a game and its story, but this fan base is really invested. I know they have a Discord channel and a wiki they use to talk about the game and document its story.
Yeah, they do. I actually chatted with one of those gamers. Michael Kittenberg has more than 1,100 hours in the game. And that doesn't count the hours he spends typing up the logs found in the game's different maps and rundowns.
Wow, 1,100 hours.
I know.
At this point, we should probably explain what a rundown is.
Oh, yeah. So that's another really cool thing about GTFO. A rundown is basically, I guess you could call it like a chapter. So the game gets regular updates, and that typically includes a new rundown, which brings new maps, new hidden pieces of the story, and other sorts of bits and bobs. But most importantly, it removes the previous rundown.
Wait, so hold the phone, because I just started playing, there's maps out there that I'll never get to play?
Yeah, exactly. And the story, often found in terminals inside the maps as audio or text files, would also be gone if it weren't for the work of people like Michael. I'll let Michael explain how those terminals work.
Basically, the levels are split up into zones, and every zone has like a terminal standing around somewhere, most zones, I should say. And these terminals are basically just computer interfaces that you can access and pretty much learn everything that you can learn about the level beforehand. Like you can check rooms, you can list resources, you can figure out where specific resources are, you can navigate just to your objective, for example. If the game says in the top left, hey, go to, I don't know, pick up cell 159, then you just insert that into the terminal and it will tell you exactly, or kind of exactly where it is. Yeah, that's kind of a big deal to figure out some of the later levels, and it's even required for some of the objectives.
Like most games, GTFO has a wiki where people can document all of how you play the game and offer up stats and tips. It was actually a missing stat on a weapon that first encouraged Michael to start contributing. He said one of the weapons was missing an important detail in its description, and it was really bugging him.
For some reason, that really was getting on my nerves, like that every other weapon had all the ammo displayed there. And just this one weapon was just like, yeah, max ammo, nothing. And I just went in and edited that out. And then I realized, hey, there's some other stuff that I could fix or like adjust or add in or something. And at some point, you just added so much that apparently, when you're just the first person to like add this stuff in, at some point, you're really invested, I guess, in my case at least.
These days, Michael contributes weekly to the wiki, often transcribing the audio logs for people who either haven't found them yet or won't have an opportunity before they disappear forever. He told me that he's probably typed up 80 logs, each taking 20 to 40 minutes to enter.
I kind of do that a lot with like kind of every game that I pick up. Like I get really, really invested in one game at a time. Most people probably like play, I don't know, five times all separately. And for me, it's basically I play like one game the majority of the time, and then I get really super invested in the game. So that's one reason. And the other point being, I read that a lot of people just go like, okay, I just figured out that they just found their first log, let's say, or they, in this rundown, they have audio logs, for example, that play automatically, and they go, okay, who is this guy who's talking to me in the first level? I kind of want to know what's going on there. And it's always like super nice to see like those people going, okay, where can I find out all this stuff? And I'm, yeah, can check out the wiki if you want. And they go like, what the f***? This is so many logs. Okay, I'm going to read all that. And then they come back and they're like, okay, that's pretty cool. That's kind of amazing for me.
Despite being so invested in the game and story, Michael really doesn't have any idea where it's headed. Of course, that's just encouraged him to play more.
The lore is basically spread out through like breadcrumbs or like Easter eggs. So we don't really know where we're going to go in like maybe like the next mission, we're already going to be somewhere completely else. But so far, it's like pretty good world building overall, I would say. You like learn about companies and then see their logos in game. And then you have characters that interact a little bit more with you. And you learn about various characters and their quirks. And like last rundown, we had a bunch of logs explaining just the backstory of the four main characters, for example, which was super cool, I think. But overall, I think the story is like, nowadays, the story is basically the main appeal for me in GTA 4.
I guess that's the question then. Is there an end to the story? Do the developers know what happens? And how long before the rest of us know?
Yeah, narrative director Simon Wiklund told me they definitely know. In fact, it sounds like they have quite a lot of world building and narrative still under wraps.
We know exactly who the characters are. We know exactly why they're there, who's kept them captive and what their agenda is. We know where the monsters came from. We know what the underground complex was used for before it was overrun by these monsters and what was going on there before. It's just a matter of when we trickle, reveal some information about each of those sort of mysteries. We release a rundown, a set of maps, basically, and then we see how the community reacts to the information that was in there in terms of the storytelling. And then we decide like, okay, the next one, we're going to lean more into this part of, or we're going to go into like, there are different threads, you know, different mysteries. And then we can focus on something else for one rundown. And then we can go back to this, or we can have a tease about something, you know, if we release sort of a 0.5 mission, you know, where the same rundown is still intact, but we add a few extra missions halfway between the two updates, you know, one rundown and the next where the current rundown is wiped, then we have some teasing sort of maybe text logs or voice logs that are teasing some new concept or some new revelations about a certain mystery in the game. Yeah. So in that regard, we're sort of winging it, but we do know where we want to end up, you know, where everything is, not necessarily everything is on the table, but enough is on the table to feel like satisfying, I guess. And then there's a situation where we want the player characters to end up that would feel sort of like a satisfying end game, I guess. Whether that's actually GTFO, you know, getting TFO, I'm censoring myself here, but, you know, if that's actually getting the f*** out or failing to do so and finding some other purpose, I'm not going to say, you know, but there's going to be an interesting road getting there.
I also asked Adam about how much narrative content already exists, since he's more involved in the day-to-day writing of the game's story. Specifically, I asked him how much material they have, and he got pretty detailed with me.
The current pace that we're doing, I think we really picked up on the pace on the 1.0 release, on the big release. But at that pace, we have at least another 2-3 years of material we could get through. There's a huge amount. We have organizational charts for all of the companies. We have interrelationships. We have breakdowns of relationships. We have marriages that fall apart and relationships that blossom during the story. Like, there's a huge amount of content narratively. But it all depends on how long the idea stays fresh, how long the fans enjoy it. You know, like I said, 10 Chambers are very connected to their community. It's really important to them how the players feel about the game. So if the interest drops, that will change things, you know. But right now, the interest is still very high.
You know, I hope it sticks around. I've had so much fun playing through it, despite failing to make it through a full rundown a single time yet. And yes, I'm being literal. I have not gone through an entire level without dying so many times that I give up. So there's that. It's a sort of game that, as Simon really described, encourages meaningful cooperative play and teamwork. When it works so well, and you feel like you really accomplished something, which is pretty neat.
It really is amazing, Brian. Maybe by our next episode, I'll have made it past the first level and to the dentist's office.
Yeah, you know, maybe we shouldn't be hosting this. Neither of us are very good at playing these games, it sounds like.
Well, that's it for this episode. I hope you enjoy learning a bit about GTFO, and make sure to check it out on Steam, of course. And don't forget to like and share this podcast and subscribe so you can hear future episodes where we'll be digging into interesting games and some of the biggest trends shaping the game industry.
This is Level Infinite is a production of Pad and Pixel LLC. Your hosts are Tony Bernhardt Jr. and myself, Brian Crescenti. This podcast is produced and edited by Brian Crescenti, Dave Tack, and Ethan Vincent. Audio engineering and final mastering by Dan Carlisle.